today on Family Talk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Family Talk with your host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. I'm Roger Marsh, filling in for Dr. Dobson on today's broadcast. You're about to hear the heroic and inspiring story of a woman who lived in Nazi-controlled Netherlands during World War II and then later joined a group of Christians that helped countless Jews escape the country.
That is one thing that I can never convey to anybody who hasn't lived under oppression, the suspicion. Anywhere could be secret police. They could be dressed like you and I, and they could be in uniform, but they could stop anybody at any moment and arrest you. So you didn't know who is pro-Nazi, who is contra. You had to be so careful what you said, to whom you said it. It was a horrible time.
Her name is Diet Eman, and she has an incredible testimony of how God used her in one of the darkest times in history and preserved her life in the face of certain death. Ms. Eman will share her harrowing account over the next 3 days. On today's program, she will talk about the beginning of the Nazi regime in the Netherlands and why she felt burdened to help the Jewish people. Let's listen now to part one of Diet Eman's story here on today's edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Well, I had just turned 20 the week before when the Germans entered our country. And we Dutch were standing there and the tears were streaming down our cheeks. They had just bombarded Rotterdam, an open city. The center was totally wiped out. So that was the beginning. And we were told what we could do. There was curfew, so you had to be home at 11. And there was we were not allowed to listen to the BBC radio. And we thought, for goodness sake, they can tell us what they want, but if we want to listen, we listen. But then they arrested you, and you went half a year to prison for listening to the BBC. And when we still were doing it, there came a rule, everybody had to hand in their radio. So the people who were a bit scared, you always have those, and that's, they handed it in, and they got a worthless piece of paper. But the rest of, well, you can tell us much more. And if you had a nice big painting or a mirror, then they took that away and made a hole in the wall and made a shelf, put the radio there, the painting over it, and every night at 8 you listened. And then somebody, if you lived in a city, you had another one walking in the street, that there was no secret police. Because that is one thing that I can never convey to anybody who hasn't lived under oppression, the suspicion. Anywhere could be secret police. They could be dressed like you and I, and they could be in uniform, but they could stop anybody at any moment and arrest you. So you didn't know who is pro-Nazi, who is contra. You had to be so careful what you said, to whom you said it. It was a horrible time. Anyway, these were the minor things. But then so many of the German Jews, the synagogues were burned, they had been arrested, some were killed, and we had thousands of German Jews who had fled to our country. And on May 10, when they marched in our country, he had already taken Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Norway, and now we and France and Belgium, there was nothing left. Spain was pro-Nazi, Franco, there was nothing left. And that night, thousands of those German Jews, they had no hope anymore, and they committed suicide. That were our fellow citizens, and here comes this power that has no right to be in our country and starts arresting those people. And then Hitler hated the Jews. And my fiancé had read a book that Hitler wrote, Mein Kampf, and that expressed how he hated them. And we knew about that night that they killed all the Jews. And where I worked in my first job, I was working right next to a guy who was a year older than I was. His name was Herman, and he was Jewish. And he was kicked out. He was not allowed to work there anymore. But he played beautiful violin. And my parents loved music, so we had a piano and an organ. And my brother plays beautiful cello. And I play horrible piano. I don't know how to count. But anyway, this Jewish guy always said, I like to play trios, and I'd come to our house. There were all these young people, there were all this music. So Herman had many times been to our house and played trios, and I always ruined it, of course, but anyway, he was a friend. And then what they did is, you've heard it, and now we look back, all the Jews were rounded up and had to go to to Eastern Europe. But they didn't know where they were going, and now we look back and we knew they were killed. But at that time, just think that some, I would nearly say idiot, decides, well, this section of Nebraska, they're all bad people, and that you get from, that the Russians would have occupied you, and that you get a note home, and you all have worked hard, and you have your homes, and you have your farms, and that that power says, you have to report that and that day, and you may not take anything along, you may only take a little suitcase with a change of clothing. And that is what actually happened. Those Jewish people had worked, they were doctors, dentists, everything. They had their homes, they had worked their whole life, and all of a sudden they get this notice, you have to leave everything behind. And they had to leave their homes. Now when that happens, and you're a Christian, and what does Jesus teach? He teaches, do unto others like you want others to do unto you. And I was brought up in a Christian home. My fiancé was a Christian. All my friends were Christians. But when I heard that Herman's family got that notice, I saw my fiancé that night, Hein. And I said, Herman has to go, his whole family. And Hein said, no, don't let him go. I read that book from Hitler. He said he's going to do something horrible to them. But we were all 20, 21. We had never been in a situation like that. We didn't know what to do. So I said to Hein, but what can we do? What can Herman do? And Hein's father was the principal of a Christian school out in the country, like here. The farms were a bit closer. You have such large areas of land. But his father and Hein had lived there his whole life, and they all knew him. He was the son of the master. They called it the meester. And he said, I know all those farmers, and they are wonderful Christians. He said, and if I hop on the train and I go and ask any of those farmers if they will take Herman, I know they take him. And we really, in our youthful optimism, we thought the war would last a year and a half. And he said, then he can help at the farm, or if they want to hide him, and then when the war is over, he can come home. So I saw Herman again, and I told him, and he said, oh, yes, please, I like to do that. But he said, I have a sister, Rosa, and she's so scared. Can you find a place for her? He said, and I am dating a Jewish girl by the name of Ada, and she's an only child, and her father died, and her mother is so scared. And within 2 weeks, we had a list, and this one told that one, and we had over 60 Jewish people who all said, can you find a place at a farm? And Hein hopped on the train and asked the farmers, and you would have done the same. They all said, sure, sure, send them, no problem. So we spread out all those Jewish people. And there is nothing heroic about it, because we thought, now we can sit back, and when the war is over, they come back. So that was nothing special, and you would have done the same. But then the Germans decided that everybody had to have an ID. Like when you drive, you have to have your driving license. So they said everybody, 14 and over, has to go to offices, and there you have to have your ID, identification card. And all the Jewish people on this page had a big, fat, black J printed, Jew. And when you stepped out of your house, even for the mailbox, you had to have this with you, because the secret police could be everywhere. They could stop you, show your ID, and if you didn't have it, you were arrested. So we all had this. And then whole Europe was occupied by the German army, by the young men, and they had already women in their army, so they were spread out. And in Germany, they didn't have enough help for the factories and for the farms. So then there was a big invitation, come to Germany, good pay, pleasant work. But there were not many takers, because in that time, I'm so grateful to the Americans, you people had joined, and all your young men came to help us liberate. We would never have gotten free without America. And I'm eternally grateful, and all the Deutschen. And so, but our men didn't want to work in Germany and maybe make bombs that would be used against our Allied friends. So the men didn't want to go. And first it was an invitation, but because very few showed up, then it was forced labor. Every man had to go, 16 and over, till 60 years, if you were healthy. And there were a few exceptions, and you were lucky. Pastors didn't have to go. From the Catholic Church, the priests didn't have to go. If you were suffering from tuberculosis, you didn't have to go. But anybody else had to go to Germany and work there. So our man didn't want to go. And here first we had hidden all those Jews at the farm, but then all of a sudden there were hundreds of thousands of men, young men, and not till 60, who didn't want to go, and they went in hiding. In the meantime, they didn't have enough food in Germany, so that was very simply solved. All the occupied countries were plundered, and we are famous for our butter and our cheese and all that stuff. Trains full to Germany, and they did the same in France and in Denmark and in every country. And we were suffering hunger. We didn't have enough. So then what was left for us was put on a ration system. And this had to last a month. And it really wasn't enough. So you were tempted in the beginning of the month to buy more bread and more milk. And then at the end of the month, you had nothing. And this was in the cities. So then when we needed places for our men, the young men, and we couldn't only do the farms anymore. We had to go to villages and cities. And the people said, we'll take them, but we need ration cards. We can't even feed our old family. We can't take a young, healthy young man without a ration card. We have to have ration cards. And then you heard about Corrie ten Boom. Corrie ten Boom group was helping Jewish people. You all know about Anne Frank. They were helping people. And our group, and thank God, over the Netherlands, many, many people were helping. And they had a list of all the Jews in the Netherlands, so they saw that they were not showing up in the amount that they should have come. So they thought, oh, those Dutch are doing something. So then on the walls in the cities and in the newspapers, there came big ads, whoever helps a Jew will be treated as a Jew. And we were all still so young and we were desperate because we needed every month, by that time, over 100 ration cards, maybe more even because there were other groups, and we needed for all our Jews. And they said, we'll keep the Jews, we'll help them. They have now been a year here and we love them, but we want that you get us IDs without a J. Now, how do you get that? So that was very difficult, and we got together. And we went on our knees and we prayed and we said, Lord, from all the nations, you chose the Jewish people to bring forth Jesus. And they may not accept him, but still they were the apple of God's eye. And we said, we believe that this is your will. And what do we do now? We don't know it anymore. We need this. And we prayed and prayed. And in the end, it became very clear to us that the only thing was to take it. And to take it, that meant a robbery on the German offices, which was, of course, very dangerous. And they needed revolvers, and there were everywhere notices. There were certain things that you went to prison for, but for having arms, for doing robberies on German offices, for helping allies who were shot down over our country, which we did too, for those things you got the death penalty. So then we decided, well, we have started it. We can't now say to the Jewish people, well, good luck. We did what we can and now find your own luck. And we said, well, we have to do that. And there were a couple of very brave young men who said, okay, we'll do it. And then from that day on, and that was 1943, and the war ended in May 45. Every month those guys, we found a village or something, and if we had a friend there, we said, when do the cards come in? Where are they stored? Is there a guard? Are there weapons? Is there defense or anything? And then the friend made a drawing that they knew exactly where to go, and then with their weapons, and they first went always on their knees, and they prayed to God, Father, we have to do this. Will you protect us? Will you also see that there is no shooting, that nobody else get hurt? And this had to be done every month for more than 2 years. And no, never was the shooting one time, and they were already outside and nobody was hurt. And I think that was God's very special protection. And then we could give all those cards. And like I told you, the priests and the pastors didn't have to go. And our young guys had to travel too, and I traveled the most because girls were not stopped, but they were all in that age group. So when those guys who did the robbery, they took everything they could find and what was useful. So then all our guys got new identification cards, and they were all pastors. So I worked with a very religious group. And then they could travel again because when they were stopped by the Gestapo, they were a pastor. And this went on for a long time. One day, I was asked, I lived in The Hague, and Hein was, we had two leaders. My fiancé was one of our leaders, so he was traveling all the time. And I was asked to go to a house, and they said, it's very dangerous there, and they won't let you in, but go and help. And they gave me a password that they had to say when I rang the bell, and they asked, then they would let me in. So I went there. I thought, well, if you can help. And I could not believe it. It was a big apartment house in the heart of The Hague, 8 stories. And I had to go on the stairs, and there were all doors. It was on the second floor, and then I gave the password, and they let me in. And they were built really for single people. It was a very small apartment, tiny living room, tiny bedroom, a kitchenette, and a shower and a toilet. And that was all, and a hall. And I came in, and in that house lived a woman in her 50s, and I was then early 20s. And she lived had always lived there alone. And she showed me she had 27 Jews in that little place. And I said, how do you do that? Where do you put them? I had never seen, because we had 2 here on those big farms, and here 27 in that little place. And while I'm talking to her, and she said, well, and she had on, like couches on the side, but that were all piled up mattresses, and she threw a nice throw over it. And then at night, she said, we spread it out through the whole house. But she had a young couple. They were expecting a baby. There was a very old man. She had everything. And while I was talking to her, I hear next door, it wasn't even very well insulated, I hear that they were flushing the toilet, the neighbors, and you heard the water stream. And I said to her, you had to think of everything. Your life depended on it. I said, have you always lived here alone? She said, yes. I said, do you know your neighbors? Can you trust them? Are they Nazis or what? She said, I don't know. In an apartment house, your life is so rushed, you don't know who your neighbors are. I said, now, when you lived alone, how often did you flush the toilet? Because if you can hear hers, they can hear yours. Maybe 5 times a day. I said, now you are 28 people. I said, that thing, if there is anybody that you can't trust, that alone would give it away. I said, do they come out in the street? She said, yes. One guy, if you see the children's Bible, Father Abraham, with that big Jewish nose, and, you know, one guy could be Father Abraham. I said, don't let them out in the street. I mean, if they are arrested and they are tortured, they will tell. And you can't blame them. I mean, I don't know if the severe torture, you broke down. So I said, you have to keep them. I said, and you have to answer the phone. So I gave her many tips. And I said, well, the only way I can help you is I'll go more to farmers, and Hein will go, and we'll find loads of places that you are left with 2 or 3. And so I went there. She said, how can I reach you? What is your name? But I was so scared. And in the war, you never gave your name, your real name. So you always took just a first name and a false one, because also people you could trust. But if they were arrested and tortured, then if you don't know it, you can't say it. So we never asked each other's name. We just say, call me John or call me this. Or so I said, well, call me Toos. And I said, I'm not telling you who I am. And she said, but if I need help, if that baby is being born or if something happens, I said, well, I live on, and everything in the Netherlands was on bikes. I said, I live that I can come to you with my job. I said, and I'll call you every day when I get up in the morning. If you need help, I can still make it before I go to my office. I'll call you an hour before my lunchtime. If you need help, I can come, and I'll call you 2 or 3 hours before curfew. And for months, I was there at least 5 times a week. I brought ration cards, I brought new IDs for all those Jews, and I took loads of them away. I think I had her down to about 8. And I was always scared to go there, because I thought, they will be arrested. They are not careful enough. They don't see the danger. This lady has a golden heart, but she doesn't use the gray stuff that the dear Lord gave us. And she is too... I was so scared to go there. So I had her down to 8, and I thought, now we are getting somewhere. The next day I come, and she has 7 new ones. And then it grew, and it was desperate. I said, Mies, as her name was Mies, I said, I'm so scared to come here. I said, one day I ring the bell or I come and the Gestapo is sitting here and I walk in their open arms. And also, if she was arrested, what they did, then the Gestapo stayed in that room the whole day, and all the incoming phone calls, they made that person answer. And then And they were not allowed to say anything, so then the underground people would still come and they would all be arrested. So I said, now I'm doing something different. I give you a password. I said, and I'll phone you still all the time. I said, but you have to say this password in the conversation, and if you don't say it, I'm not coming. That means that the Gestapo is here. And so one day, and I said, and don't let the Jewish people answer the phone. So one day I phoned and a man answered. And I phoned a couple of hours, and I didn't like it. I hung up. A couple of hours later, I phoned, man answers. The whole day, a man answers. So at 5 after my work, I took my coupons, because right across was a little food store of that apartment house. So I took a coupon, and maybe some of you have seen the movie The Hiding Place, and then you saw how that truck and those soldiers and the helmets and the bayonets, and that is how it was. Now, if that had happened there, the whole day, the conversation in that food store would be about that. So I thought, that is where I can find out. And I took money and I come to the food store, and sure enough, they were all arrested.
Eerie words from Deet Eamon as we end the first installment of her talk here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Roger Marsh, behind the mic for Dr. Dobson today, and if you'd like to learn more about Deet Eamon's story, head over to our website at drjamesdobson.org. That's drjamesdobson.org, and then click on the Broadcast tab. We enjoy hearing how Family Talk has impacted you and changed your life. And if you have any comments or stories on how this program or any of our other broadcasts have impacted you, call our listener feedback line toll-free at 844-823-2669. That number again is 844-823-2669. From the very beginning of our ministry, our mission has been to strengthen and advocate for the institution of the family. One way we're able to accomplish this goal is through our library of resources. Now, if you're struggling in your marriage or you feel like a failure as a parent, keep your chin up. We urge you to check out all of our great materials on our website. We have countless resources for moms and dads, husbands and wives, on topics like how to grow spiritually and how to fight for your family. When you go to drjamesdobson.org, click onto our Resources tab, and there you'll have access to all of our books, CDs, DVDs, and downloads. Again, for your benefit, all of our helpful materials are available at drjamesdobson.org, and then click onto the Resources tab. Be sure to join us again tomorrow to hear part two of Deet Eamon's fascinating story, right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Roger Marsh. Have a blessed day.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
Someone once said, if you remove the rocks from a brook, it would lose its song. Well, that holds true for you and me as well. Author Scott Walker tells of the time he was asked to help some friends dig through the ashes of their house after a fire. When they arrived, all that was standing was a portion of the outer brick wall. Where the piano once stood lay only a pile of ashes and twisted wire. Nothing had survived the blaze. But while sifting through the debris, Walker came across a tiny china bluebird. He wiped away the soot to find that the colors were still bright. A few hairline cracks had formed in the glaze, but beyond that, it remained intact. Walker writes, "As I gazed down at the bird's small beak and two black eyes, I wanted to weep. If only this little bluebird could talk, what a story it would tell. A story of the heat of the night, of terror, of survival against great odds." And then the crucial question hit me. Why did this china bluebird survive? It had survived the fire because it had been tested by fire. And so it is with human beings who have been refined in life's raging furnace. They are tougher, harder, and more resilient than those who have never faced difficulty and loss. That understanding may help us cope the next time the heat is turned up on our tranquil little world.
You can find more Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson at myfamilytalk.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Tim Clinton, President of the American Association of Christian Counselors and Executive Director of the Center for Counselor Education and Family Studies at Liberty University. Man, I'm so excited to tell you about a brand new program, an exciting opportunity for you to better yourself It's a tremendous educational resource. It's the all-new James C. Dobson Center for Child Development, Marriage, and Family Studies at Liberty University. Liberty has partnered with renowned psychologist, author, radio show host, family expert, Dr. James C. Dobson, to create the Dobson Center, where you now can study in three different majors, marriage and family, child development, family advocacy, and more, and become even a certified marriage and family relationship coach. That's right. You can go to college at Liberty and learn from Dr. James C. Dobson. He actually teaches video lectures, consulted with numerous experts from the field, and more. I hope you'll take a moment just to check out these brand new programs of study at Liberty.